All right, you're all set.
Okay, thank you. So I hereby call to order this regular meeting of the DES DDD District Central Independent Oversight Committee. Today's date is April 25th, 2025, and the time is 10:05 a.m. It's a regular meeting of the IOC and is being held electronically and being recorded. And the transcript of that recording will be posted on the ADOA IOC website. In an effort to avoid excess background noise and potential microphone feedback, please mute your microphone when you're not speaking, and the host can mute you, but then you can unmute yourself when you'd like to speak, and just click on the microphone icon at the bottom left or wherever it is on your platform. Additionally, I've been asked to read the following statement. Do we have anyone that has to disclose a conflict interest? And if there is, the committee member should disclose now and disclose why. Okay, no conflicts today. So we'll go ahead and begin with the agenda, and let's see, we'll start with, I'd like to move things around a little bit, and number one, I'd like to actually go to number two, if at all possible, and I know that Megan, you're on the call, right? I was wondering if you had any updates in regards to those bills, and I just wanted to leave it on the agenda since it was kind of still in motion, to see if there's anything up, any updates on that. And those were the bill updates of the, go ahead.
Before we get started, do we want to do introductions to establish?
Oh, yes. Them? Yes, please. for some reason, yes, that would be great. My name is Lisa Elleberger. I am District Central IOC Chair, and my background's in school psychology and marriage and family therapy. I also am co-guardian of my cousin who is 50. Actually, she just turned 54 on Monday. And yeah, and I've been a part of IOC since approximately 15 years-ish. District Central. If you can help me, Morgan, that'd be great.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks. Mandy? Hope we can't hear you, Mandy. Okay, one second.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Mandy Harmon. I am the Vice Chair of District Central IOC. And my background is, of course, I'm a member, first of all, of DDD. And I have been in the education field for 20 years.
Thank you. Eva? Oh, we can't hear you either, Eva. Mm-mm. Oh. Okay. We'll go back to Eva, Carolyn.
Carolyn Wilmer. I'm a volunteer with the IOC.
Thank you. Mike?
Hi, my name is Mike Johnson. I use he/him pronouns, and I have been with IOC, I think, almost a year, maybe not quite yet, and I have a background in a master's in social work, and I've been working in community behavioral health with the IDD population for about 4 years now.
Thank you. Megan?
Hi, I'm Megan McCarthy. I have a doctorate degree in clinical psychology and a background in mental health, working with the DDD member population, DCS, as well as specializing in child development and neurodivergence.
Thank you. Molly?
Good morning. Molly Olson, volunteer with IOC. My background is in public policy, really focusing on healthcare, Medicaid, et cetera. And I also have a sister who's a member of DDD.
Thank you. Eva, you want to give it another shot?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So I'm Eva Hammett, and I've been a
longtime member, and I used to be a trained facilitator in person centered planning. And I have an adult daughter. She started out, I was a child member, and now she's the adult.
Thank you. Christina?
Sorry, it takes me a minute to get off of mute. I'm Christina Hedges. I am the Division's Office of Individual and Family Affairs Administrator. So I support Joan, who then supports Morgan and Michelle. So happy to be here.
Thank you, James.
Hello, I'm James Mayo. I am the District Central Quality Assurance Manager. I've been with DES for 27 years.
Wow, thank you. Patricia?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Patricia Sandino. I'm the PRC Chair for District Central. I've worked for the state for close to 30 years. With DDD, I think I have 5 years. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Joan?
Good morning, everyone. I'm Joan McQuaid. I'm with the DDD Cares Administration, and I'm here supporting Michelle and Morgan.
Thank you. Yes, Mandy?
I just want to check my audio real quick. Can you guys hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Larry?
Good morning. Larry Allen with Arizona Department of Administration.
Thank you. Frederica?
Good morning. This is Frederica Graham with Access.
Thank you. Wendy? Oh, we can't hear you, Wendy. You're on mute. No.
Wendy Herring, Mercy Care OIFA.
Perfect. Thank you. Yes, Carolyn?
Sorry, I meant to add, I was like distracted by my dog. I just wanted to add that I have a background in public health and early childhood health, and my late sister-in-law was developmentally disabled and a member of DDD. And that's it.
Thank you. Michelle?
Hi, good morning. Michelle Rademacher. I'm a DDD Independent Oversight Committee liaison, and we work under the DDD OIFA umbrella.
Thank you. And I'm Morgan O'Hara. I am the counterpart liaison, Michelle. Is there anyone that we might have missed? I think that is everyone from now. We may have others joining us a little bit later.
Okay. Carolyn, did you have a question? Your hand is still raised. Just curious.
Sorry, no.
Okay, no worries. So we'll go ahead and go.
I don't know how to make it go away.
Okay, it's fine. I'll try and remember that. So just unmute yourself. Goes away. We'll go ahead and start with the agenda items. We can either do the bill update or we could go right into policy. I just wanted to kind of get the bulk of those two kind of first before discussing some other items. Megan, are you in a place where you can maybe discuss the bills update, or if there are any updates? If there's none, you can state none on those bills that were discussed last month.
Yeah, absolutely. Just as a refresher, the Oklahoma bill that was brought up before, that was introduced in January to abolish the mental health department and substance abuse services and transfer its functions to Department of Corrections. The bill is still under consideration in the legislature with a proposed implementation date of July of this year. So not much movement, still under discussion. The South Dakota bill that would require school counselors and school psychologists to notify parents about any discussions at all about gender
is also still under discussion, so no movement there. And also the House bill in Congress regarding health and technology, where it would allow and establish a program to train artificial intelligence AI to essentially prescribe, maintain, and determine what kind of prescriptions that you would need, essentially, which there's some concerns there. That is also still under discussion in Congress as well.
Awesome. I just think it's important to just kind of keep an update on those. So thank you for sharing that with us. We'll go ahead and do we have any questions or comments on those? Okay, we'll go ahead and move forward. I'd like to go right into the policy issues, et cetera, on number four. That's Eva, those are the areas that you wanted to discuss in regards to like when voting on open policies and changes in definitions.
So here's what I'm going to leave 310B off the discussion until after maybe we vote. So here's what I have. So 410 is maternal care services, and both the MEDS and the ADSS needs the member defined. In 930, is implementation and fidelity monitoring of SAMHSA, evidence-based practice. The MEDS and the ADSS needs a definition for serious mental illness. 1620-E is service plan monitoring and reassessment standards. And this is the one that's sort of a little mushy because they need home and community-based services defined. And in one of their discussions, they talk about person-centered needs assessment, but it is not defined. So it needs to be defined. They need to define person-centered planning. And then they have some weird thing in there called person-centered service planning and reference 1620-D, which, so I don't understand what the person-centered service planning is other than the fact that maybe they need a planning meeting defined. Then in 610, access provider qualifications, in the med division, they need home and community-based services defined. In 960, quality of care, in the ADSS, they talk about reporting to independent oversight committee, and that is not defined. And in 1021, both the MEDS and the ADSS, they need to define the member and the support coordinator. So, okay. And then what happens is in when we submitted the stuff for Article 8, we talked about the planning team, and we added the fact that a DSP who works in the member's home and has direct knowledge of the member and the support coordinator. And so in any of these bills that have the planning team, I'd like to add that little caveat that we put in Article 8. And so I'd like to make a motion that the IOC updates all these definitions in all these different policies.
So you'd like to recommend making a motion that the IOC District Central comments on the updates to these policies.
Yeah, because they're
described.
Yes.
Okay, I have a question for you in regards to when you mentioned the 960 quality of care and ADSS reporting to IOC, and that needs to be defined. What do you mean by that? Like what part needs to be defined? The outline of the reporting to the IOC, or what it is that's being reported?
No, there's a whole section in the ADSS entitled reporting to independent oversight committee. And what happens is usually when they have mentioned like independent oversight committee, it is defined in the definitions and it's not So I have to come up, I have to find a definition for the independent oversight committee because under, so in the med section of that, quality of care does not mention the independent oversight committee, but they do have it in the ADSS. They have a whole section. There's a one.
Well, I wonder if we can, I wonder if we could recommend a hyperlink to that section. And then that way it's, it goes right to the definitions.
No. What happens is in every one of the policies, they have a list of definitions before they talk about the policy.
Yes, I've seen.
And so what we have to do is in the, so when you make the recommendation, you have to put in the definitions, we need to add the independent oversight.
Okay. I hear what you're saying. So basically it's missing under like almost like the table of content for that policy under the definitions of what they're going to be discussing within the policy. Okay. I just wanted a clarification on that. I mean, it seems everything seems kind of straightforward in regards to the definition. So these are all kind of more like clerical type and organizational recommendations for the policies. So you're recommending that either you'd like to do the motion?
I made the motion. Okay. All those that I listed that we correct the definitions in, and it has to be done before May the 2nd. And okay. I will do that because it is a big pain in the butt.
Okay. So Eva is making a motion that the District Central IOC approves the corrected definitions as described in the policies listed of 410, 930, 1620E, I believe, 1620D, 610, and 960, and 1021. So do we have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, that was Molly, I think. Molly second?
Yeah.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed to making the motion? Okay, so we have that motion completed. Thank you, Eva.
So I do have for the 310D, it was brought, you brought that up at the statewide. And Zane,
are you talking about the ACT?
Yes. And so
okay, and we have another agenda item on that as well, but go ahead. We can start with that one.
So
we'll
what
start
happened,
with number one.
So I think what happened is I think it may need the SMI defined, and where they put it they talk about the doctors. I deleted that. But anyway, they talk about all the doctors who subscribe to it. And so what my suggestion when you talk about it is the fact that we put that the member has informed consent and define
the informed consent. That's one of the areas that the subcommittee discussed.
Yeah, and then put in the definitions informed consent that when they when the doctors write this prescription, that the member has informed consent. And if not, then it needs to go before PRC for approval.
And okay, so, let me go ahead and when is, I mean, I have, I don't have the date and I was looking at my document.
It expires May 2nd.
Okay. So what I'd like to do before we discuss that piece or like, well, I wrote that down to add to it, but we did have a subcommittee discussion. Remember last month, I believe we developed one, and that was myself, Megan and Michael, and Mandy was a part of it more on the virtual end. And so we do have some information in regards to this that we discussed. I'm going to go ahead and start with that. Basically, when referencing that 310B, Behavioral Health Service Benefits, Chapter 300, it basically indicates that the division shall require the ADSS to ensure medical service provided as by a licensed physician, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, or nurse, that they're covered as health plan benefit to reduce the number of symptoms and improve or maintain functioning, including A, medication, B, laboratory, radiology, and medical imaging services, C, medication and outpatient electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, and outpatient transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS. In reference to ETC and TMS, one of the one thing that's coming up is that there's a statute that basically states that the division is prohibited from supporting, I'll read it, statute, Arizona Revised Statute 36-561, prohibiting certain treatment or drugs and use of aversive stimuli. Under that is A, no psychosurgery, insulin shock, or electroshock treatment or experimental drug shall be administered by the department to any client, nor shall the department license, approve, or support any program or service which uses such treatment or drugs. And then B goes into the aversive stimuli, which isn't completely related to the ETC TMS. However, if you want to read it, I think I've sent it to all of you. The department shall adopt rules, regulations specifying the aversive stimuli used for any DD programs or services directed by a licensed and supervised or supported by the department. Copies of such rules shall be made available to parents, no aversive stimuli shall be used or permitted by the department in any such program or service except in accordance with the adopted rules and regulations and the client's individual program plan. So that's kind of separate from the what we're kind of focused on, which is the no psychosurgery, insulin, or electroshock treatment. So one of the questions that I brought up in a statewide was that since the ETC is technically a form of electroshock therapy, how will DD and the division approve and support this service and also be in compliance with ARS 36-561? So that was one question. And that's when Zane did mention that that would clearly cause a conflict in being able to provide that in policy when it's a state statute that states that the department can't support those types of services when individuals with developmental disabilities are involved. We had some other conversations about it as well. However, with our subcommittee, we discussed some concerns, which number one was that how is it going to actually be in synchronicity? How is it going to be written in policy when it's against Arizona revised statute? So I think it had to do with basically the answer was the statute would need to change. So in regards to the 310B, since it's an early notification, and so the concerns are when an individual is in an inpatient facility and their treatment is resistant to medication injections, how will this be available for use on these individuals based upon the behavioral health practitioner order, and how frequently will it be allowed? Because as it's written in this early notification, it's super, super vague. The other concern or question would be what behavioral health team will make the determination if their brain can handle that sort of treatment. And Megan or Michael, please chime in. Feel free to interrupt or interject. And the other question was, how do we know how their bodies will react to those treatments when many individuals supported by the division are already having difficulty with self-regulation? And I think we also added, there are also individuals that are already, this potential side effect of ECT, making certain there's explicit understanding, which can exacerbate behavioral symptoms, including an increase in agitation, aggression, memory loss, and confusion, of which many DDD members already struggle with, and of course, the medical complications. And what data will be required for the follow-up care and monitoring of the success of treatment in DDD members? What data will be collected prior to the use of the ECT treatment? And how will the success of the treatment be measured? Because asking the client and member does not always work with DD members, of which many members can be influenced in their responses or are not clear, especially for those that are not their own guardian, or they have a public fiduciary, and their staff are the ones that help guide them through a lot of these appointments, the group home staff, the ADH providers, and then also those that we, as we know, if you've sat on PRC, some individuals that are their own guardian that have significant cognitive or intellectual disabilities, and they are their own guardians. However, they have difficulty with receptive communication. They have difficulty with expressive communication. They have difficulty with understanding. And if you look at their PCSP risks, they're at risk for exploitation. Who's going to be monitoring these? Because we also see a lot of plans in PRC that have 5 different mood or behavioral modifying medications for mood disorder. So it's almost just another, anyway, that we didn't really go into too much, but there's also the potential overuse of the treatment, and then it becomes used to try and fix prior to the use of other less invasive treatments or behavioral techniques. And then I just had a question mark here, the overuse to try and fix disability characteristics such as perseveration or emotional dysregulation in autism, cognitive disabilities, and communication comprehension. But Megan, Michael, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add in that about potentially making these comments.
I was going to add as well, because I started thinking about this, is that I think that ECT needs to be separated away from TMS. Because they're two very different and distinct treatments. ECT must be conducted in a medical or hospital setting, whereas TMS can be done in a therapist's office. You're not going to go to your therapist's office for an ECT treatment. These are two very different things. And I feel like with how it's currently written, it makes it seem like TMS and ECT are one and the same, and they're not. And I think too, also by separating it, I think it needs to be differentiated from just typical behavioral health, because of the fact this is going to be conducted by more of a medical professional than even someone like myself, who's a psychologist or a therapist. We would not be qualified to provide such a treatment. So I understand that's under the heading of behavioral health, but I don't want there to be confusion that this can be conducted by somebody like me. Like, you're not going to go to a psychologist and be like, hey, I want ECT. We're going to refer you to a medical professional for that, because it is going to be in a hospital setting. So I am concerned with how it's all written out, like medication, therapy, TMS, ECT. We start with least, you know, restrictive always, and then ECT is sort of the last thing, but it needs to be clearly stated this is a medical procedure that's being done.
Yeah, and I think that as it's outlined in the policy, it kind of even says that, it kind of outlines that, but it doesn't necessarily differentiate them in that number 3 policy for acute services. So with that being said, are there any questions or comments from the IOC District Central? I know that we've discussed like the possibility of ECT going to PRC or IOC. However, right now goes against the state statute, which it makes it not even able, in my thought, and what I've heard from the division staff, or what I thought I understood, was that it really can't go into policy until that statute is changed. Eva?
Well, another one of the early policies had to do with access, where it said if access approved a treatment, then, and this is what Zane brought up, if access approved it, a procedure, then DD supposedly would be discriminating if they did not allow their members to do it. And so whatever we do, I appreciate Megan talking about separating it out. And so whatever we decide, it needs to be written in policy, whether we want to make a decision. We don't have, it might not be improved, but if we put something into policy, that policy will not go into effect post probably, and will have to be reopened. So we need to make a comment someplace about the fact that in statute that DD members are not allowed to have it. We need to have something. We need to make something
for sure.
So I have something to do about putting in the definition of informed consent.
And that is, the concerns that I read off and the form, and basically that was a document that was taken from our subcommittee discussion, and it outlines and references all the above except for the specific of informed consent. However, the questions and comments are related to that. So with that being said,
what I'm saying is you have to take what your subcommittee did and your recommendations, and you have to write
in. I have it written down. We have a document already I'm reading from. That's where I was asking you if you can help me with that. I sent you an email asking if you could help me put that into the comments. I've done my own individual comments, but I've never done a policy early notification policy comments as District Central IOC. If IOC.
IOC has to vote for it.
But let's first finish the conversation. There's a couple more things. So I definitely like the addition of recommended that the ECT be separated from TMS due to their differences in the practitioners being able to administer the treatment. So we can write something like that. I can add to this document in regards to requesting and recommending a separation of ECT and TMS so that they're differentiated and they're not viewed upon as the same type of administrators. I mean, it can be. I think TMS can be administered, I'm guessing through, and I'm just assuming because it's under this policy, can be administered by a medical service team, et cetera, a nurse practitioner, licensed physician, physician assistant, or nurse. As covered, which are covered as health plan benefits to reduce the members' symptoms, improve maintaining and functioning, etc. However, it doesn't necessarily state that ECT can only be like. So I think that they're bulking the TMS with ECT, maybe because they want both of those services to be ordered, and provided within the scope of practice by the medical service team, which would be licensed physician, nurse practitioner, PA, or RN, or who knows if nurse is also could be LPN because that covers both, just the name nurse. So we can wordsmith that a little bit. And then I would also like to recommend that it just a recommendation to the policymakers and or discussion of DDD to potentially have it minimally be reviewed by PRC to include an IOC member or an IOC, either IOC district approval. And then as far as I know the whole concept about the access piece, if access approves the procedure, and this is where I asked Frederica, I emailed you, I don't know if you're on the call, Frederica, I emailed you in regards to the early notification or the policy regarding ECT and TMS. I'm not sure how I can get that access policy because I was told from an email from the division's policy team that they couldn't give me the access policy, that I'd have to contact access to get that policy. Does anybody on staff here know how we would get that access policy?
So I emailed to try to get the information. I haven't heard back from that person, so I'm not sure exactly who holds that policy currently, if it's open or not. So I'll follow back up and see if I can get the details on it for you.
If we could also include the ketamine therapy, and because I think ketamine is also an access approved therapy, and that's also a fairly it's mind altering in some form, emotional altering. I don't know if Megan, if you want to add a little bit in regards to that, but those are also techniques and treatments that potentially could, that our DDD members have not been that may not have been exposed to, which could trigger additional characteristics or behavioral characteristics that are not, that may not be in their best interest. It may not, it might improve one area functioning and then decrease another area functioning. So I know that's the rationale of, like, if Access approves a particular treatment, then it should be available for all DDD members. However, there's also psilocybin is in the process of being approved, from my understanding, as a treatment for PTSD. I'm not sure if it's also being considered for major depression, et cetera, as well. But those are just some things that I think we need to kind of think about and keep an eye out when these potential treatments start to become Access approved, if indeed they do in the future. But we know that ECT is, and so that's why we're kind of focusing on that more so, because it is a form of, it still falls within that that electroshock treatment. And so I don't know if, I know this is kind of a little bit scattered. Carolyn, you have your hand raised. I'm not sure if it's your permanent hand or, okay. You're muted if you're speaking, Carolyn.
Sorry, yeah.
It's okay.
Access policy, it should be online on their website.
And it might still be an early notification.
Okay, then it might not.
Yeah. That's what we were.
Yeah. Sorry, I forgot about that piece of it.
It's okay. No worries. So as I, we have until May 2nd, which is, we need to make these comments prior to the next, probably like within the next week or so. So I'd like to recommend, and I'm going to make it just more, a little bit more vague, that the District Central IOC, if someone would like to make a motion that for the District Central IOC to make the following comments and recommendations to the open policy, early notification policy of 310B in regards to the scope, the medical services provided in relation to ECT, asking, or stating that since ETC is technically a form of electroshock therapy, how will DDD and the division approve or support the service and also be in compliance with ARS 36-561? I think that needs to be in there. And then list the ARS, which could be listed easily by just copying and pasting. And if the division and the ARS 36-561 are in alignment, present or future, we would like to recommend ECT to be clearly outlined and specific in this early notification policy. It is vague and it is not clearly outlined. We're recommending to include age requirements, research-based appropriate use. It's currently severe mania and or depression. And if they live in an ADH or group home similar to the BTP requirement, have the treatment be reviewed by an objective entity, IOC volunteer group, and be presented and reviewed by the individual's DDD district IOC, previously Human Rights Committee, prior to the division supporting or approving the treatment. What are your thoughts on that? That part, Eva, does that kind of fall within that line of the informed consent, et cetera, that an objective entity reviews it? And I can add PRC in that. I put similar to the BTP requirement. If the division and the ARS statute are in alignment, present or future, we'd like to recommend ECT to be clearly outlined and specific. In this early notification policy, it is vague and not clearly outlined. To include age requirements, research-based appropriate use, currently severe mania and or depression, and if they live in an ADH or group home, similar to the BTP, and I'll put BPP / PRC requirement. Have the treatment be reviewed by an objective entity, an IOC volunteer group, and be presented and reviewed by the individual's DDD district IOC prior to the division supporting or approving the treatment. It's just a recommendation.
Well, actually, I don't know. I never put recommendation in there. I said, this is what we want done.
So, well, we could also add, yeah, I can put that we'd like this completed, done, and we can add for informed consent. I can add informed consent for the members to be for informed consent.
So if you
like due diligence.
So if you're going to do a recommendation, then somehow, I don't know, I'm not real good at doing it, but somehow or another, you need to put in there that ECT is done in the hospital versus the TMS that can be done in an office. So that
the policy itself actually defines as as outpatient, but outpatient could also be outpatient in a more controlled medical facility. It doesn't have to be outpatient in a therapeutic room or, you know, whatever it might be. I mean, outpatient is vague. So, and we can add that as well. That's already in here as well, recommending the definitions and the separation of ECT and TMS, differentiating the teams qualified to perform.
So yeah, outpatient could also be like IOP. So would this be a part of like an IOP treatment?
An IOP is?
Intensive outpatient treatment.
Thank you.
So what we're going to have to do is, since you can't make a motion, we need Megan to make the motion.
Or Michael. So I mean, so basically it would, I'll repeat the motion. Would somebody like to make a motion, if you're in agreement with it, that the District Central IOC make comments and recommendations on early notification policy 310B?
You have to do two of them, one for the medical and one for the ADSS, because it's listed in both policies. So what happens is 310-B is, there's a medical one and there's a 310-B, an ADS.
Yes, we have copies of both, but they state the exact same thing. So we can state first the medical one. So the motion would be, do we have a motion that the District Central IOC recommends the following comments, recommendations to early notification 310 on the medical policy manual, or the medical, they both had that wording. So that's okay. I'll just say the medical, that the District Central IOC make comments as recommendations in reference to ETC and TMS. It's quoting that since ETC is technically a form of electroshock therapy, how will the division support and also be in compliance? Outline that. And recommend that if the division and the ARS are in alignment, we would like to recommend ECT to be clearly outlined and specific. In this early notification policy, it's vague and not clearly outlined, to include age requirements, research-based appropriate use. I could add informed consent. And if they live in an ADH or group home, similar to the BTP PRC requirement, have the treatment be reviewed by an objective entity, IOC volunteer group, and be presented, reviewed by the individual's DDD district IOC, previously Human Rights Committee, prior to the division supporting or approving the treatment. And then outline the concerns, which we went over. The concerns are when an individual is in an inpatient facility and the treatment is resistant to medications, will this be available? So we're kind of giving them the details that we think should be in the policy pertaining to ETC.
I'll go ahead and make that motion.
Okay, Michael makes a motion for District Central IOC to comment as an entity to policy early notification policy 310B under the medical policy in relation to ETC, and how the division is going to support this and also be in compliance with ARS 36561. In addition, the recommendations as described. If the division are in alignment, recommending ECTB to clearly outlined and having an oversight committee, or if they live in an ADH or group home, similar to VTP requirements and PRC. And also outline the concerns and questions as we discussed. Does that meet the requirement for a motion, Morgan and Michelle? The long one. We've stated it like three times. It should. Okay. Thank you. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Megan, second. And all those in favor, say aye.
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 And any opposed? Okay. So we'll go ahead and make that motion, and myself and maybe with Eva's help, I will be adding that to the 310 policy.
My goal is to make another one to do.
Yes, we're working on that.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yep. So now we need somebody to make a motion in regards to, let me read it again, in reference to ETC and policy 310B under the ADSS policy. That the District Central IOC make the following comments, questions, and recommendations in regards to the division, how will the division approve, support it, and also be in compliance with ARS 36561, define the ARS, and recommend that if they are in alignment, present or future, we'd like to recommend ECT to be clearly outlined, specific, to include aid requirements, informed consent, research-based appropriate use, and if they live in ADH or group home, similar to BTP PRC requirement, have their treatment be reviewed by an objective entity, IOC volunteer group, and be presented reviewed by the individual's DDD's district central or district IOC, excuse me, prior to the division supporting approving the treatment, along with outlining the concerns. Do we have someone that would like to make that motion?
This is Carolyn. I make that motion.
Carolyn is making the motion for the ADSS. For the District Central ILC to provide those comments and recommendations to the ADSS 310B early notification policy regarding ECT. Do we have a second?
I'll go ahead and second.
Michael seconds. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, awesome. That was a kind of a big one. And so thank you so much. We will, what we could do is we'll, since we're in a subcommittee and we've made this motion, would it be like we did with Eva's with the Article 8, since it was such a large entity, and we've discussed the areas that we're going to add informed consent and then add that PRC comment, PRC piece to it. I think we can move forward if we're all in agreement with that and we made that motion for that. We added it in that language. So thank you all for bearing with us as we navigated that important early notification policy. And I think Frederica did ask me something in the chat. I will respond to it as soon as we get to the, I have a moment, excuse me. So we did one, we did two, we did four. Number three is more of a discussion. It's kind of more of that discussion on PRC, BTPs, and PCSPs. And so I think that we could probably add that to that section. But number three, the discussion on a process when a guardian passes away. I've been involved in two PRC meetings in the last month where one, the mother passed away and the individual did not have a co-guardian and has a brother, but the staff was having a hard time getting a hold of family or the brother. Mother was a payee. And the individual, although the group home was taking care of the individual's basic needs and making sure that that individual had all they needed financially, however much, or what they wanted to buy, a coffee or a soda or a book, a notebook, or a workbook, they basically said that they were providing those. However, they hadn't been paid in 6 months. And they requested a pub fiduciary. However, they said that the brother hasn't gotten back to them. And it seemed like there wasn't really anybody really pursuing, maybe making sure that family member really knew the importance of having this individual having a guardian, continued guardian in their life. And then also the staff also said, and Patricia, if you're here, we can't, of course, talk about the individual name, but you may want to chime in of what your thought was in that. The other thing was that they mentioned, oh, well, there are other families out of state. You know, that person has a cousin in another state. And so I spoke up and I said, even if the family member's out of state, that out-of-state member, that out-of-state family member can still be that individual's natural support system and even apply for guardianship and support and assist the individual's quality of life and just in general, having somebody there that I think would also reduce the amount of public fiduciaries that are needed. If there was some kind of DDD process where it's not just, oh, we called the family and they didn't call us back. And then there was another one that was like somewhat similar, but a little bit different. And so I just wanted to get feedback on others if they've experienced that in PRC, if they've been involved in PRC, or I would think that maybe even an IR would have been written for a member not being able to access their funds. Would an IR be written for a member not being able to access their funds, James or anyone?
It could be. It also could be a customer service issue, where they went to customer service if they were having access, you know, having difficulty accessing their funds. But
this individual is not verbal.
It doesn't meet the policy requirement because that's not an incident. It doesn't meet the requirement of an incident. But that doesn't mean that people won't make that referral to us.
I'm just a little bit concerned for those individuals that Eva, you have your hand up. Go ahead.
Well, there's two issues here. One of them is the guardian, and the other one is who is the payee for his funds. So the support coordinator could possibly talk to Social Security.
The deceased mother was the payee.
So what happens is they need to have maybe the support coordinator to go back to Social Security, because if the mother was the payee and she dies, that means he is most probably going to get all of her is going to get all of his Social Security. So technically, if he is now his own guardian, because you do not have another guardian, he can have the support coordinator talk to Social Security, and maybe then DD can become his payee. So as you do the finding a guardian or whatever you're going to do, at least he can get his money because he is now his own guardian, and he
can
Social Security and get his finances, and then maybe
I hear what you're saying, Eva, and I would know how to do that. And I know some others. I mean, it's just what I guess this is more of a systematic thing that I'm just bringing up, is that it's not isolated to one member. It was something that I wanted to bring up after I was in PRC, and it happened with two different individuals this month. Also there's a concern that also was brought up, is that if DD becomes the payee, they're not able to have an ABLE account. That was something else that came up. Does anybody know about that? And
That was from my understanding,
they can still have an ABLE account as well. However, there was a client, an individual member that was denied an ABLE account because DD was a payee. And that I can't remember. And Patricia, if you're on the line, if you can help me remember, I think it was accounts. What is the division's name for their accounts department?
Client funds?
I think it was client funds, yes. It was client funds. Client funds stated that they could not have an ABLE account if DD was the payee.
So that's what we got from the support coordinator, according to
correct.
We asked for it.
And from my understanding, that's not a go ahead, Patricia.
No, go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, no, that's you were about to say from your understanding.
So my as far as I'm concerned, the support coordinator is, if they have these, situations, is that the DDD automatically assigns themselves as the payee. And then, of course, the member becomes his own guardian. The problem with him being his own guardian, some of them are capable, right? And some of them are not able to maintain their funds. And so I know we work closely with the teams to make sure and encourage them to get them a guardian. But I think the teams struggle because sometimes the families do not want to be the guardian. And then that's one problem. And then the other problem is, a lot of our folks are being denied by the PUPFEDs. So I know Behavioral Health Administration has checked into this. I haven't heard any updates lately, but I can definitely check for IOC.
That would be great. And I think that Christina mentioned that she reached out to Clients Funds Manager to find out. Because from my understanding, and also Christina mentioned, I believe a member can still have an ABLE account. I also, she answers raising her hand. Go ahead, Christina.
Okay, so I reached out and she said that DDD will resign as a rep payee if an ABLE account is open. So it sounds like it is not possible to have both.
Okay, and then what happens if they resign as a rep payee and the individual is not capable of managing their own finances in that way?
I am asking that as well. I would assume that we would help refer the member. Oh, thanks, Michelle. Michelle's putting it's a conflict of interest with the terms of the ABLE account.
For DDD to also be payee and to have an ABLE account. Yeah. It makes sense. I mean, it makes sense.
So I would assume that we would help refer the member, connect the member with another payee source.
And what are those options?
There are, as Michelle just put, there are paid payees. You pay like a small amount, I believe, each month or each year so that they can help you manage your money.
Okay. And then they are PUP fiduciaries. Can they also be the payee or no?
I believe they can. Michelle says yes.
Yes, they can.
Yeah. And then isn't a PUP fiduciary? I mean, do they get funded through as being a payee, right? Or would it not be from the individual funds? Is that through DDD?
Can you ask that question one more time?
The public fiduciaries, Michelle raised her hand. Maybe she.
Okay.
So a PUP fiduciary, if the state public fiduciary office accepts an individual to be their public fiduciary, it does encompass their finances as well as their medical decision-making abilities.
Okay, and then my question was, do they also get compensated? So would they be considered paid payees or
no.
Would they? Okay, so it's a separate entity, like a separate type of role. So with a PUP fiduciary, public fiduciary, the Social Security pays for that, or DD?
Well, what I was about to say is the Social Security office can provide a list of approved fiduciaries. They're not a public fiduciary. They're a financial fiduciary that could be utilized in cases where individuals have resources above what DDD would want to be involved with. And that's why the ABLE account kind of comes into play there, because if the person is above a certain amount of resources, and I'm taking this from my past experience as being a support coordinator, but if a person above a certain amount of resources, then they don't qualify for DDD's payee program. They do qualify for a monthly fee fiduciary program, and Social Security does provide a list of those that they approve for use in these situations.
Okay, so with those, I'm guessing that they're not the fiduciaries, because I've been involved in fiduciary situations where they drain the individual's account by charging so much. So these are like specific for potentially DD members or individuals that are could be at risk for exploitation.
Yes. Well, and I'm using the wrong term, fiduciary, because my brain can't pull out the other term right now this morning. but from when I was involved, it was just a couple dollars a month that was charged to the individuals, less than $10, I would believe, for those services.
Okay, excellent. That's good to know. And the reason they're kind of connected is because if the individual had a guardian, the guardian was the payee, the guardian deceased, there's nobody else, no other family member that would like to take on the responsibility of guardianship. However, they also have an ABLE account already, then DD would have to resign. They wouldn't be able to accept them as a payee, and they would be recommended to either have a public fiduciary if they need one for medical and finance, of course. And then, or if they don't necessarily need that, or the courts decide that they don't, then Social Security can recommend what you're stating as fiduciaries, but there's another name for it, for a nominal fee monthly to be a paid payee and help manage the resources. Would that be accurate, Michelle? Yep. Okay. Yes. Okay. So I think that kind of helps that issue. And it also, when it comes to guardians, co-guardians, guardians that decease, just something I wanted to bring it up because it has come up twice in PRC where individuals, somebody passed away or somebody was no longer guardian and the individual was over 6 months of not giving any funds. And I think they didn't even know if the mom was still listed as payee or where the money was going. And it had been over 6 months, which seems like a long time, especially for the agency not to be getting the reimbursement for also for room and board or anything. So also in that same regard, I also experienced just how easily other guardians or other family members could be eliminated from the situation of being involved in an individual's life. Let's say when the mother, the aging parents are the ones that are the primary in the individual's life. But new staff come in and they don't know, I'm also supposed to invite this person. This person's been involved in all the meetings. There have been situations like that I've been involved with and where either I'm not being invited. And I know it's more so just that change in staff, I think, that really impacts that, where it's either a change, usually happens when there's a change in support coordination or a change in group home or ADH staff or teams kind of are moving around. Just something to kind of think of. If there are no more questions in regards to that or comments, we can move on to other agenda items. Carolyn?
I just wanted to make a comment. That's just, this whole thing is disturbing, but the idea that a support coordinator changes and they don't know that they're supposed to invite other family members, I mean, that's just really inexcusably poor case management. And, this is something I really, coming from a Head Start background, which is a social services program with a strong emphasis on case management, this is something that I really notice about DDD is that people don't feel like they have to put it in writing. And, things need to be in writing because that's how, if one person leaves and another person comes on board, that's how you have continuity of information.
Absolutely.
And so
it was very disturbing.
Appalling. Yeah, really, really appalling that you wouldn't have a simple list of who needs to be invited to meetings, who the family members are, and how to contact them. I just find that incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, I do too. I think also it, the other thing too, is I think that there's often there are guardians that are, they know about the PCSP and they're always involved in the PCSP and in maybe some behavioral health appointments, and they're in their members' homes and involved weekly. And then they don't go to the PRCs. And I think sometimes Wendy's hopping off. Thank you, Wendy. Hopefully, I don't know if you're coming back or not, but I think also maybe the guardians are not relayed the importance of a PRC. I mean, a behavior treatment plan is like a PCSP, if not even more in depth and detailed. I think maybe guardians aren't really aware that the PRC is extremely important for them to be involved in and be a part of. I'm not sure if that message is really being sent out to individuals that are maybe newer to the BTP meetings and requirements. Eva? Eva?
Yeah, I had to unmute. So I did participate in an ABLE account presentation, and I will contact the ARCA Tempe to find out where it was, because they talked about the ABLE account and how members could get an ABLE account. And I will see if I can rustle that up. And two, okay. When Carolyn talked about support coordinators, there is a lot of responsibility coming down the shoulders on the support coordinators.
For sure.
And one of my IRs, which I made a comment on, was the fact that the support coordinator was having trouble contacting the guardian and all this other stuff, and he wasn't getting his appointments and all this other stuff. And it turned out in one of these early policies, they actually talked about the process of how the support coordinator is supposed to send a certified letter to the guardian to disenroll the member from access. There's actually a process for it. And so
to disenroll the member from access for,
well, because when there are certain requirements that I guess when you become a member of DDD, first of all, access and DDD and all that other stuff. And if you don't follow the policies for that, then supposedly the support coordinator, there's a process for disenrolling the member. And when I read the IR, I did not write it down. I just made a comment about it. And then when I was reading early policies, it was actually in the policies the procedure that the support coordinator had to go through to disenroll a member. They have to send a certified letter to the guardian to disenroll them. And so
I'm curious as to if I'm Carolyn, I see that you have your hand up, but I'm wondering if there's anybody that can help explain what that is, this requirement to disenroll a member, if I'm not really following that. Does anybody know about this early policy and the process for disenrolling the member? Mandy?
I just wanted to explain to you. So that's part of the member handbook for Altex. You have to stay in contact with DDD. If you do not, they can disenroll you from the program. That's on every year when I sign my papers, that's what it says.
Okay, so it's basically like stating if you're not gonna follow or be in communication with, let's say if there's an individual that is leaves their ADH and decides to go live on their own and not contact DDD.
No, right? It has to do. It has
yes.
to do.
Okay, that makes sense.
When they want to have a meeting and the support coordinator contacts the guardian and the guardian does not show up for the person centered service plan.
So it could also be related to the guardian, and even if the member is in an ADH or a group home, then that guardian could be basically removed as guardian and they would request for a public fiduciary or something else.
No,
Christina?
No, they would disenroll. Get involved with guardianship stuff at all.
Okay, so I'm not sure if it's related to anything, but maybe what we could do is put that on the parking lot in a parking lot and add that to the agenda for next month. Let's wordsmith what that is, because I'm curious as to what it is, but it's also not really following along the agenda.
Well, actually, because they were talking about guardians and all this other stuff, and Carolyn talked about support coordinators, and actually. Because James is on the thing, when I made that comment, I just wanted them to understand that there is actually a policy on thing that if the support coordinator can't get a hold of the guardian and all that other stuff, that the support coordinator is required to send the certified letter.
Okay.
To the guardian.
So I would love to have that discussion. I'd like to maybe add it to our agenda for next month, because I think it's a little bit off track of the agenda for today, but I wrote it down and I'll send it to Morgan and Michelle in regards to that. And I'll CC you, Eva, or blind copy you. Okay. And you tell me if it kind of triggers your memory in regards to what you were discussing. So I'm going to go ahead and if there's no more comments on that, I'd like to kind of move on. But with the other thing in regards to that and support coordination and funding and not getting a hold of the guardians or whatever it might be, we also know support coordinators have a high caseloads. And so it could also just be that their caseloads are so high that they're feeling a little bit overwhelmed during those 2 months and maybe miss one of the guardians and don't invite all the guardians or whatever it might be. So I want to acknowledge that it may not be a poor support coordinator. It could just be an overworked support coordinator.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that.
Oh, yes. So I'm going to skip number 6 and 7 because I think that those are things that or number 6. Do we have any updates on that? I think there is a subcommittee going on for that, but I'm not sure if there's any updates. Number 6 is quality of care, mental and medical facilities and DDD members. So we're going to just put that on the shelf and continue. Go ahead.
I'm not quite sure, but we did have somebody else join us today. So I just wanted to make sure that she gets introduced.
Okay.
So we have Dr. Copeland with us this afternoon as well.
Okay. Excellent. And so that actually, I think that's related to this agenda item, correct? Or no? And the questions.
I think that was in relation to the questions that you had submitted.
Yes. Okay. Yes, and that the District Central submitted. Yes, and I don't have those questions in front of me, unfortunately. I have to let me find them. But if you have them, and would this be a good time for you to just kind of share your, if you want to introduce yourself and give us a little background, that would be awesome.
Okay, sure. Thank you. My name is Vicki Copeland, and I am a family doctor, and I'm one of the medical directors for the division in healthcare services. And I've worked for the division for about 3 years. And so I did get the questions. And so I don't know if you just kind of want me just to talk in general about them or if you want to ask me them more specifically or how you'd like me to do that.
If you want to just talk in general at first and then I'm going to pull it up. And I believe we also can if you wanted you can also read one or two and that if you want to, and then that way we can kind of get on that subject, because I'm looking for it, that would be awesome.
Okay, well,
and I apologize, I didn't know that you were going to be in attendance today, so but thank you so much.
Okay. Well, and if it's not on the agenda for today and you need me to come back, then I could do that also.
Oh, we just forgot. They didn't tell us you were coming. So we're ready. We have questions. Lisa just has to look them up real fast.
Okay. Okay. That sounds good then, Mandy. I'll go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my understanding of the questions really has to do with, you know, the quality of care that people receive while they're in either a physical or behavioral health facility. And, you know, just kind of all of that it entails, right? And so I guess from the division's perspective, right, like I think we all want people to have quality of care. And we understand that when people are in the hospital and it's outside of their normal environment, where everything that, you know, they're used to doing and used to having is different, that it becomes really hard. And that is for anybody who's in the hospital, right? It's not our normal environment. We don't have our normal routines. We don't have our normal people around us. We don't have our normal stuff. But sorry, Mandy, go ahead.
The one specific question we had related to that, because I helped Lisa with these questions, is that, like, for me, for example, when 20 years ago, I had a need to go to a behavioral health hospital, but I had extreme difficulty finding one due to my physical disability. Like, there wasn't anyone to take care of both of those issues, right? So it took a really long time for me to find appropriate placement, and I think that's specifically what I'm talking about when I ask the question, but also for, like, the members that aren't like me, that aren't verbal, how their quality of care gets met because their staff isn't allowed to be with them, right, in the hospital because it's double billing.
So. Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you for adding that additional information and detail. So, I mean, you know, I wish the world was different, right? And I wish that we didn't even have to have this conversation, but we all know that is the reality. And at the division, you know, especially in my area, we continue to push and to advocate and to, you know, explain to people that if you cannot make these accommodations, then you are discriminating, and that this really is not okay. And we do understand that it happens, but every time we hear of an instance where, you know, because it can be like you're talking about, Mandy, even things that are just, you know, minor, like somebody uses a walker, but the staff comes in and moves the walker so far out of reach that the person can't get to it, right? And then, like you're saying, that people's normal staff aren't available, and we do have certain policies that if somebody needs certain attendance and care in the hospital, that can be a consideration and can be paid for. But then there's always kind of that overlap of funding, and so we have to be sure that it's not something that the hospital is themselves required to do. But of course, that's not your staff. It's not the people you're comfortable with and that you have a relationship with. And so, you know, I think that we're always looking at these things. And when we hear of any instance, you know, the people at the division are not afraid at all to get involved and to advocate. And sometimes that means going back to the health plan and saying, you know, these are the examples that we've heard about, or this particular instance is going on right now and it needs to be solved. And, you know, filing a quality of care concern. If we hear about an instance of something going on, then we want kind of that paper trail too for that to be investigated and to be looked into. And if a corrective action plan is required, to have that occur. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. I had a question. Like, you mentioned something about, like, if the issue needs to be resolved right then, or if it's happening right then and there, how is it that individuals can reach that support? And you mentioned something about quality correction. I know there was, I think I'm mixing the two. Because I know that there, one of the reasons this came up is we have, hopefully she's able to hop on. It's another IOC member. She's not here today. But we've heard of different situations where an individual, maybe a child minor, going into an inpatient facility or medical facility or mental care facility. And let's say they're letting the minor walk around barefoot throughout the hospital when that minor has, I don't know if they have, they maybe were supposed to be wearing their braces, leg braces, or AFO equipment. And then they come home and their legs are all swollen. Situations such as that even as well.
Yeah, that, so.
And how they get their adaptive equipment.
Yeah, so. I mean, you know, I think every situation is very unique, right? And it's something that sometimes have to be dealt with on a case by case basis. But if everybody's just better informed, then, you know, we'll all do better. And so I think that sometimes people just aren't aware, right? And they need to be made aware, right? We can't just assume that they know. And then sometimes there may be two conflicting medical conditions, right? And so while somebody has something that they normally would need to wear AFOs for, their leg braces, you know, because they have an ulcer, let's just say, on their ankle, then they can't wear their leg braces. And so sometimes it's just explaining, well, you know, we don't want you to do this at this particular time because there's this other situation going on. But if that's not communicated, then nobody knows. And they think that it's, you know, an error, or that it's an oversight, or that they just don't care and they're just not trying. And so we really need to ask the questions, and we need to advocate. And it can be, you know, it can be really hard, but I think that if, as, you know, the person going into the hospital, or as a parent or guardian, you know, if you do your due diligence to say, you know, I need this, this, and this, and these are the reasons, and those are ignored, or those aren't taken into consideration, then I think that's concerning. And then that's when we want to have people let, you know, either let their support coordinator know, or if they have a district nurse, let their district nurse know. Let their health plan care manager or their liaison know, so that we can intervene and say that, you know, these issues are going on and we need to address them immediately. I think, Mandy, you might have your hand up. I thought I saw another one, but I think yours is up.
I know another question we had. Before I forget it, we had some questions on coordinating discharges. Like, you know, if a member has to find, like, a different place or go to a rehab facility, how do they get all their adaptive equipment that may
they may need a rehab facility or wherever they're being discharged to. Like, we wanted to know what the, you know, like, what they agree or how you, like, discharge planning was coordinated, if that makes sense.
It does make sense, yeah. I mean, so, you know, so hospitals are responsible for a safe discharge plan, and even if that's a transition of care, right? And so to a lower level of care, like a rehab from an inpatient facility, they are responsible for that. And both facilities are responsible, you know, if you have equipment with you at the hospital and you get some type of transport, then there's, you know, a responsibility that equipment follows you. And, you know, sometimes that's a effort on everybody's part, right? It may be that, you know, you have to be transported in a non-emergent ambulance and all your equipment can't go in that. But then, you know, either family or guardian or somebody will need to take some of those things. But we should expect that if you move to a rehab, that they also want you to be as independent as you possibly can. And in order to do that, you need to have access to your, you know, your equipment, your DME, your AAC or whatever device it is that you're using, and that those things not get lost and that they be placed in a place that's available and accessible to you. And that during those transitions, that information also follows you so that people are aware, you know, if you wear glasses, if you have a hearing aid, if you use a walker, because the goal is to get you as close to back to your normal state of function as you can. And that's whether you walk or use a wheelchair or use a walker or, you know, are able to, you know, mostly sit up in bed. I mean, whatever it is, we want people to regain as much as possible after a hospitalization. And that requires having, you know, having your stuff with you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I think Megan had her hand up. I'm not sure if Megan, do you still?
No, she ended up actually answering my question.
Okay, awesome. Okay, and then I did want to just kind of share this information. So it was basically what we've already been talking about some of the questions that we've sent to the division, but it was basically to assist us in understanding how quality of care is monitored and collaborated, such as adaptive equipment, AC devices, preferred methods of communications, functionality of daily living, listening comprehension, overall compliance of expectations. If a member goes home with discharge papers, the member going to understand this, or is someone else responsible for the discharge instructions, especially if a member will be somewhere for a while? How do the staff know how to care for the member if the member is nonverbal and do not have familiar staff with them? I think that's kind of a big one, right? Two, Dr. Copeland, I'm not sure, like, how do the staff know how to care for a member when the member is nonverbal and do not have that familiar staff with them? I think that there oftentimes we get in incident reports that sometimes are related to situations where situations occur when the individual is not able to express their pain, their needs, their what they need in the facilities.
Yeah, no, and I mean that is definitely difficult, right? I mean, but our hope is that when people enter, you know, whether it's the emergency department or the hospital or the rehab center, that the people who are most familiar with them either are able to, you know, speak for the person if the person is nonverbal, or explain how the person communicates so that they do know what to look for or what the signs are, and that you know, some of that is documented in the PCSP. So if that information is available at the time of admission, then, you know, making that available, you know, having, being in the hospital stinks and it's not easy for anybody, but having, you know, certain disabilities can make it a whole lot more complicated than it needs to be. And, you know, I think the other thing is that we have to hold people accountable, right? When shift change happens, right? One person may be very, very good and very attentive, and then the next person comes in and they are much less attentive, or maybe they're more busy, right? To give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they're more busy. Maybe there's something else going on. But making sure that all of that information is conveyed from one person to the other. And the longer that somebody's in the hospital or in a rehab, the more attentive we have to be to that, right? Because people can be at risk for getting, you know, bed sores or skin problems or, you know, ulcers and wounds. And there's a lot of things going on. Yes.
I guess you mentioned something, which I think, and I'm not really aware of this so much, but aside from, I know that the staff, when they, maybe if they need to take an individual or a member from a group home to an urgent care, they often, you know, they have their binder, they have their, that individual member's information on like a binder, at least I know my cousin's program, group home has something like that. But how often do you see that in the hospitals where they actually have the person-centered service plan and behavior treatment plan if that individual is on or has a behavior treatment plan? How often do you see that actual, that those documents being copied and main, being in the file, the medical file, or in the hospital file for these individuals when they're in either a mental inpatient or a medical inpatient?
I would say not very often. And I think that's unfortunate, you know, because I do think there's a lot of information.
Absolutely.
In those documents. And, you know, when I was in outpatient, you know, in family medicine, people would bring in their binders all the time. And so I was definitely familiar with that, but I was their primary care physician, right? That's a lot different situation than being in the hospital. And so I do think sometimes, you know, having that information available, but also pointing out what the important parts are, right? Because sometimes people see, you know, a 20-page document and they don't want to read through that. They feel like that's not relevant, but pointing out the parts that are relevant, or, you know, each person that works in the hospital kind of needs different information. And so sometimes if it's just in there and you say, I know you don't think you need this, but just make a copy and put it in the file, because maybe the social worker is going to find it helpful, right? Or the physical therapist is going to find it helpful, or the speech language pathologist is going to find it helpful. And so I think sometimes just being a little bit more persistent, like, no, I want this to travel with me, you know, or I think you're going to need this if you're the responsible person, because it's going to come in helpful, you know, down the road.
Well, it definitely can help even just in the interaction between medical doctor, nurses, and the individual that's in that room. Because it describes their forms of communication, what works for them, what doesn't. I think it would actually be beneficial for any person that's going to interact with the member for them to have that in their files. Mandy?
I just wanted to say that I haven't been, like, when I go to the hospital, I'm the book, right? But I know, like, for my roommates, the staff will take the book and will offer to make copies. They'll offer to make copies of meds or whatever's in there. And like the emergency room, for example, is just worried about getting that person stable to go upstairs. So they don't want to look at it. And by the time they get into a room, the staff's no longer there with that information. because they can't leave the book. So I was just wondering, what does DDD do to help provide, like, providers through the health plans to be trained to, like, look for that useful information? Like, is there a training program or something like that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any training programs for things like that. I think that there are different things that, you know, that we're trying to do. We're having, you know, a group of physicians where we're doing a lunch and learn, and we're trying to advocate for, you know, higher quality of care for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and making more information known. You know, I think that the support coordinators.
I have a question real quick. I'm sorry. Do you think that that's something that would be helpful to offer to providers that provide DDD services, since the health plans are now integrated?
I definitely think it would be helpful. I think the question is
how to implement it, probably.
Right. Yes. Yes. The implementation, I think, is the hard part, right? Because is, you know, there's the individual physician or nurse practitioner or PA, but then there's also the big facilities, right? And
there's also the residents and the resident supervisors and the medical students and the, you know, blah.
You're right.
Nurse, yeah.
Yep. It's a huge system, right? And so getting that into kind of the culture is, I mean, it's a big task, but it's an important one, right? Because, I mean, our whole, or I guess maybe not everybody's, but my focus as, you know, as a family doctor is really about health and prevention, right? And so the more that we can do to help people understand these things, you know, maybe then we can prevent some hospitalizations. We can prevent some, you know, worsening of chronic conditions. And so, I'm going to write it down as an idea and try to think about how we can have kind of that. I just have a
question. An offer to you. If you find that there's some kind of advocacy that you need to happen for that, we as a committee could maybe help with the advocacy to help you implement something. I'm not saying that we can do it all, but we can try, because we have connections with legislatures and things like that.
Okay, I appreciate that offer. Yeah, let me give it a little bit of thought and see which direction that we already have to go. But then if we need some additional help, then I definitely will come back, or I'll run it by you and see what you think about it.
We just think this is an important issue because there's so many members, unfortunately, aren't like me. They can't speak for themselves. I'm very lucky that I can speak out and tell people, hey, you're doing it wrong. They need you to do it this way, please, or, you know, whatever. But I'm trying for all of my peers that are nonverbal. I get concerned for them when they go into the hospital. So.
Yes, absolutely. I understand your concern, definitely.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Copeland. And I think what Mandy said, I ditto that. I mean, we definitely see that there's a across ages. We see minors that this impacts. Children, adolescents, as well as many adults, of course. I just had an idea, it kind of came to me when you were kind of brainstorming with Mandy too, is that I don't know if it's something that maybe could be written in policy, if it's an access policy in regards to, I don't know, and then it trickles down to the DDD policy and support coordinators or some kind of something, someone else within DDD being responsible for making sure that that, like, even a PCSP and BTP, a behavior treatment plan and person-centered service plan, making sure not offering a copy, but providing the emergency room and the urgent care and the hospitals with a copy rather than offering one. I mean, I don't know, but those are just a couple of ideas, and really appreciate you coming here and sharing your expertise with us. Eva has a question.
Oh, can I, before she asks a question, I'm sorry, Eva, give me just 1 minute. I want to follow up on that. So when you're talking about providing the PCSP and the behavior plan, who are you thinking might need to be responsible for that? The division or the person going to the hospital? Or the person accompanying the person to the hospital?
I think it would be the person accompanying the person to the hospital. I mean, that would be my opinion, because then that person then is the person that actually provides it. Like, so let's say that if the individual is an ADH or an adult developmental home or at a group, and this is primarily for individuals that don't have guardians, right? That the guardian's not going to be right next to them. But let's say they're in a group home or an ADH. If they're in their family home, that's probably going to be something different. But when they're in a group home or an ADH, maybe a requirement would be that not just having one copy of the PCSP and BTP, that they always have two copies at all times in that individual's binder. And that when they go to that hospital, they just give them a copy. Or if they're going to the emergency room, they just provide that copy and say, this is a part of the individual's important care. I'm not sure. Just an idea.
Sorry, I just thought of something. You know, when you go to the hospital and they ask you if you have a living will or stuff like that, if there was a spot to add, like, the PCSP or, like, even one page of the PCSP, like, you know, helpful hints, to add to, like, their living will or whatever that guardianship document is, that might be the place to put it.
Okay. Thank you both for these ideas. I think they're very helpful, and I definitely
awesome.
It's making my wheels spin, so we'll see what we can do. Thank you.
Thank you. And Eva, then, did you still have a question?
Oh, yeah. So, Dr. Copeland, are you on the mortality review committee?
I am not.
Okay. Thank you.
No. Uh-huh. Anything else?
Okay. I think that might be it. Thank you so much, Dr. Copeland. Really appreciate you attending our meeting.
Okay.
And you're welcome back anytime.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Have a good day.
Thank you all. Okay. Bye-bye. I'm going to go ahead and I skipped a couple of things. I just want to, do we have any, in regards to, and I know we're running short on time, IOC member discussion requests for future agenda items or educational presentation. If there's any ideas that you have now, you can share with me, or share with the whole IOC, and, or of course, please look at agenda number 5. Anytime any idea comes up, just email me. You can email me and I'll add it to the list and then maybe call you and find out if I need clarification or understanding of a discussion you'd like to have presented or here in the agenda. Mandy?
I just want to let Larry know before I forget, they finally reset the course for me, so I'll be taking that sometime this week.
Thank you. Eva?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't look at the agenda, but last time you had the death mortality on the agenda.
Yeah, it's member death discussion, number 13.
Is that on this time?
Yes.
Okay, so I will wait.
Okay. We're going to skip number 7. Christina?
Yeah, I just wanted to touch on that topic a little bit. So while the division
obviously really welcomes any topics, suggestions, questions, whatnot that you all have. And we, you know, any specific questions that you have, it's incredibly helpful for us. Moving forward, though, to ensure that the division is able to provide the most accurate, you know, transparent, clear response, it's the division will be deciding who is going to be coming and speaking about those topics. So, for instance, we had a request for Dr. Mahoney to come. However, the questions for Dr. Mahoney were not related to her role within the division. So the division will be going kind of back course. Within ourselves to figure out who the SME is or the subject matter expert
for sure.
to come and present that.
Thank you. Yeah, we're going to skip number 7 because the person who was requesting that is not here today, that IOC member. Okay. So we're aware of that. We know that we can't choose and it's really just whomever. And I thank you for clarifying that as well. Let's see. I know we have number 8, but in the meantime, before we, number 8, Megan, is that something that I think that was Megan in regards to number 8, loss of grant funding to the state and elimination of the Charting My Path for Future Success program? Is that something we can table till May, or would you like to briefly discuss that?
No, we can table that till May. That's fine.
Okay, we'll keep that for May. And then 7 May, 8 May. Number 9, quarterly statewide chair IOC meeting update. I'm going to briefly go over that. I know we're really low on time here, so I'm going to try and go quickly. The April statewide was this last Wednesday. There was a discussion on, overall statewide membership and volunteers are increasing. It looks like consistently across the state. There was a discussion of the strategic planning update, vision versus mission. They want it finalized by July, so that's still a work in progress of their 5-year strategic plan. Eva, if you guys want to add anything else, please feel free. And we'll move on from there. And of course, there was concerns when it comes to funding. I think that there was in the midst of the statewide, there was they were still developing or coming up with an agreement, I'm sure. And I believe they did come up with something. I don't know the details of that right now in regards to the state funding. And we can maybe discuss that a little bit later in the meeting. And then I think that it was actually a very short meeting or less, lasted less than 2 hours. I think that there was just a lot of there was a big focus on the budget and the potential possible cuts. And without going into the details of it, I think it's everybody's pretty aware of what the possibilities are when it comes to the eliminating of different programs and government programs across the nation that will be impacted by federal decisions. And then Zane had an update in regards to agreement between legislature and governor. And I know that there was a discussion of the supplemental budget. It was looking somewhat promising at that time. This was just 2 nights ago. Eva, Eva, go ahead.
And Christine gave a nice presentation on the Homestead Act.
The Homestead, the Ombudsman, wasn't it?
The Homestead update.
Homestead Act. Yeah, thanks, Eva.
It was a Homestead Act, yeah. Mm-hmm. I was getting to that. And then did you want to share a little bit of that about that, Christina, since that would be part of your update? Maybe?
Sure, I can. I guess kind of an even bigger update than that is that the supplemental budget was signed by Governor Hobbs yesterday.
Awesome.
So we are good to go for fiscal year 2025. Amazing news. Angie, our fearless leader, it was her birthday yesterday and she used her birthday wish for that. So we're very grateful for her. Let me see, kind of the big updates that we have in terms of Olmstead are, if you give me 1 second, I can pull up my presentation and just read some quick things off. We are in the process of pre-leasing a few new units for our affordable housing program in the Bullhead City area. The division did have their first member move into the Globe apartments, which I have talked about previously. And we are in the process of getting some new units later this year in downtown Phoenix and Camp Verde. We are currently monitoring 195 members in our Justice Reaching program. Those are members who are either incarcerated, on probation, on parole, or have had or are currently in the middle of court proceedings. The other really exciting update for that is our Justice Outreach Coordinator, her name is Molly, has created this beautiful presentation that she will be giving to corrections officers and other detention staff, as well as law enforcement agencies, crisis response agencies, that really kind of breaks down what division membership looks like, how to best support division members when there is, you know, when they are in jail or prison, or when there is law enforcement contact. And she gave the presentation to our leadership team, and it is, I'm telling you, it is a phenomenal presentation. So we are incredibly excited for her to get out there and start giving it to others in the community so we can kind of support members in that aspect as well. What else? The Behavioral Health Administration is going to be offering lunch and learns to our qualified vendor agencies, as well as our behavioral health providers. They did their first one a few weeks ago on the fundamentals of autism, and they had over 100 people attend. So again, we're just really kind of getting out there and trying to increase knowledge as much as we can. There are still over 10 HCDS services that we are soliciting for as part of our request for qualified vendor application, and those are on our website. And the division does continue to move forward with working towards our accreditation through the National Committee for Quality Assurance for Case Management for long-term services and supports. So those are kind of the big updates of that. Yeah, Eva.
Thank you.
Well, piggybacking with your person-centered planning enhancements and what we just heard from Mandy about doing that, years ago, they had a grant with Dr. Small, and they did what they call person-centered profiles. And they would have a picture of the member, and they had their likes and dislikes and all this other stuff. And it's just like a little one-page thing. And actually, you know, in how they update the person-centered service plan, and lost the essential lifestyle planning, you know, they sort of lost all that, but that one page profile would satisfy Mandy with Dr. Copeland in when people go to the hospital, that, you know, they can laminate it, you know, that has their picture, has how they communicate, what they like, don't like. And I just was wondering if you could dig up that information and pass it around. It came out of Jocelyn Bell down at the, I can never remember what
the Sonoran you said?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that would be just, I took that workshop and I thought that was just really wonderful. And that would help Mandy and Dr. Copeland when people were in the hospital.
Okay, I'm writing all that down. Okay. Laminated to bring with to hospital. Okay. Yeah, Lisa.
That's also something that is really helpful when involved in crisis as well. My aunt's been using that since the 1980s. And it's like an 8.5 by 11 laminated card. And basically it gives the key points of the disability, their communication level, medications, if they are on medications, and just a brief.
Like a face sheet, almost cover sheet that just kind
like
of.
Like 8.5 by 11 that says, instead of them asking questions, you hand them the laminated card. And it basically says, this is my name. I have autism. My communication, I speak two to three word sentences. I may say yes when I mean no. I may say no when I mean yes.
Got it. Okay. Perfect.
Age, date of birth, things like that. And then also like allergies.
Ooh, good call with that. Okay. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Okay, I've got that written down and we will share that.
I never seen that document, but if they could put like a little blurb about what works like for the member really quick, what doesn't work, like they're like the major things, especially for autism and nonverbal members. They just can't.
Yeah, for sure. That's.
And we're trying to make it easier for providers, not harder. Like,
yeah, and
handing them, because I think my PST is like 40 to 60 pages. They're not going to read that when I go into the hospital, right? So if I couldn't speak, they wouldn't know. But if we had like a one page thing, they could put it on the room. So any staff thing going there from the hospital could just glance at it real quick.
Love that. Yeah, I'll definitely take that idea back.
Okay.
Thank you.
Of course.
I know we kind of moved around a little bit, Morgan and Michelle, so I apologize. I'm going to go back to number 10. We kind of already discussed that's PRC, BTPs, PCSPs. Is there anything else and related to that that we want to discuss? Okay. Number 11, I don't think we need to discuss this at this time on committee membership. I don't think we have anybody on the meeting that's a possible new member. Number 12, discussion review of incident reports and behavior plans. Is there any general discussions that are needed in regards to mainly incident reports? Because we are behavior plans are on the BTP section, number 10. Okay. And then member depth discussion. If there is any discussion, just a reminder, this is still open the public. It's not executive session. So if it's any specific member name, we'll need to wait for executive. Eva, general. Eva?
Between doing my hand, the finger, and the thing. So what is really important is early policy 910, quality management and performance improvement program components. And part of that had to do with the monitoring of lithium and all that. But on page 42, the moratorium review committee shall review and evaluate all members' mortality, including death of a member with an SMI designation. And they will use the process to identify and address negative trends, such as a lack of provider reporting. And they have another one about how the is used to analyze and identify possible vulnerable and at-risk members or member populations. So when we are concerned about mortality, they have to do that. It's now an early policy about they have to evaluate all of the members' deaths.
Would you be willing? How long is that policy open for? Did it just come out?
Oh no,
it's been a while.
You have to do the comment on it is May the 2nd. All these
policies. Okay. So would you do me a favor, since you have that policy handy? Would you be able to send it to all of the IOC members and blind copy us?
Well, I'll send it to you, and you can.
I'll do it.
Or maybe I could send it to Morgan, okay. And then you can blind copy.
Awesome. Just so that we can have it on our radar as to what it says, and then we as individuals can always make comments to those policies if we wanted to. But I think, Eva, I think you're just sharing it to, for us to be aware as well, right?
Yeah. And okay. The other one, so it was on page 43. Here's the page number. Well, I'll write it in the email.
It's email. Perfect. Thank you so much, Eva. Really appreciate it. Okay, before we go to DDD staff updates, I'm wondering, okay, before we go, we will, I don't know if we need to go to executive session yet, so I'd like to open it up to public comment before we go into DDD staff updates, if that's okay. I think we've done that in the past, put it right in that spot. So at this point in time, I'd like to extend a welcome to any member of the public attending this meeting of the DDD District Central Independent Oversight Committee. You're invited to make a comment if you wish, but your comments will be limited to 3 minutes. And there will not be a discussion following your comments. Thank you for your adherence to this time. Do we have anybody from the public that would like to make a comment? Okay, no one from the public, and then we can carry on to DDD staff updates. Morgan and Michelle, if you can help me out with that, that would be great. I think, Christina, I think you already kind of gave your update since we were kind of already talking about something, so really appreciate it.
Of course.
Yeah, I think our staff we have here is going to be James and Patricia. So if they, either of them have an update.
So this is James. So I have a new incident specialist starting on May the 5th. And I also have sad news that one of my other investigators actually put in their notice. Their last day is going to be at the end of June. So we'll be looking to hire a replacement for her. She's moving out of state. So those are my only updates.
Thank you. Patricia, do you have an update?
I think Behavioral Health Administration is just put out to hire a new BCBA on board. So we're looking forward to get someone else to with that background to help not only behavioral health, but also PRC. So that's exciting for all of us at PRC and behavioral health. So it is posted as of today. So hopefully we get someone for that spot. And that's the only update I have.
Thank you. And Joan?
Hi, everybody. I just wanted to announce that I'm going to be retiring at the end of June and celebrating my retirement with a trip to Alaska for the summer solstice. So my last official day of work is going to be the 18th of June. I just wanted to make sure everybody knew. I'm not sure if they're going to be opening this position for a placement before I retire. In some cases they do. I know they did for Leah, but she had a much more important role than I do. So they may not be opening up the position until after I'm gone. So
congratulations, Jenna.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure working with you all. I'm hoping to travel and do whatever I want whenever I feel like it. It's going to be a big change for me, but I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
I'm really glad for you.
You never know, you might want to come back and volunteer for something or another.
Lisa, I can't hear what you're saying.
Oh, I said, you never know, you may want to volunteer too.
You kind of sound like you're underwater. Better.
Okay. Yes, it's this, I have a headset that when it's low on power, it turns into rain. So I said, you may want to come back and volunteer sometime.
Possibility.
You never.
All right, I think that is all of DDD stuff. Hope you're muted.
Next would be updates to ADOA.
Hey, good morning. No updates from ADOA this morning. Any questions that I could take from the committee?
I only have one in regards to the bios. If you would you be willing to send us a link as to where that would be if we when we start submitting those? And you're welcome to add mine to that site, and then I'll add a picture in the future.
Yeah, sure. I'll be happy to send that to the committee.
My first person one. I think I sent a couple examples to the committee. And I think Eva also, I think Eva, you're ready to have yours put up too, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So all other IOC members, please feel free to keep sending them. And if you want help, I'm more than willing to help you as well.
I just have to find time to do it.
You know, right? Thank you so much, Larry. And if you could send us a link so that we can kind of see how it looks too, that'd be awesome.
Will do.
Okay. Updates from anyone left in the integrated health plans and access?
It's Frederica with access. I don't have any updates, but happy to take any questions.
Okay, Frederica, I'll go ahead and look at that, what's on the site. And then if it's the same thing, I'll email you and say, yep, that's it.
Okay.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much.
No problem.
That was in regards to the ECT and access policy that we had discussed at the beginning of the meeting. Is there anyone else, Morgan, that's here from?
I believe that's it.
Okay. I know that Mandy, did you have something for the health plan that we'll maybe have to just wait and we'll maybe remind me or we can add it to the agenda early on?
Yes, I do. But let's make sure that gets to the top next time so that we can get it.
Let's if you can give me an agenda item with it and I can send that off to Morgan or send it to Morgan and CC me. Of what the subject would be, it'd be questions for health plan, maybe?
Yeah.
Okay. If we could just add questions for health plan, that would be great.
Yeah.
Up in the upper part of the agenda, that'd be awesome.
Like it's specifically like durable medical and adaptive equipment questions, if you need it specific.
Okay. And then updates from DDD IOC liaisons.
Yeah, I just have a quick one today. So for your data for the month of March, the committee was given 823 incidences in the shared drive. There was 26 questions submitted to the quality assurance. On the next DDD IOC statewide meeting is scheduled for July 23rd at 10 a.m. The time has moved. So just be on the lookout for that. And the next DDD public town hall meeting for members, families, and providers will be held Thursday, May 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. And that is all of my updates.
What did you say changed to 10:30?
Or the statewide. It was
at oh, that's right. Okay, it's going to be at 10:30 in the 10 a.m. or 10:30 in the morning?
10, I believe.
10 a.m. Okay, I thought so too. Perfect. That will be in July.
Correct.
On a Wednesday. Okay. Do we have anybody else from DDD IOC liaisons, Michelle? Or no? Okay. So now we are going to go into executive session if we need to. Is there any, I'm not sure if today if we have anything that needs to go into executive session. I know we've gotten quite a few responses. If we do not need to go into executive session, I just need to hear from all of the IOC members, or at least if you do have something that you'd like to discuss that's specific to someone's name, then we'll need to go to executive. If not, we can.
I was wondering, last time we had an issue and I thought James was going to check it out. And I was wondering if he found out any information.
And if it's not, if we don't need to go into executive for it and speak generally, we can continue to have the session or have this discussion in this format. So
you have to remind me what it was.
I know that's the problem we're having because when in executive, if we can talk numbers, can we still say numbers in this format in the public section? Larry, is that correct?
Yes, you can. You can state control numbers on the.
Okay, so reports. We can state a control number.
I think it was 214-03-107. I think it had problems because it had crossed agencies. And I thought you were going to find something out about it.
Can you just tell me the number one more time? It was
214-03-107.
I think this is the one I elevated. Yeah. Yeah, I did elevate this one, but I have not gotten a response back.
Okay.
This one from last time, yeah.
They must be having problems.
Well, DCS is a different agency than us now, so.
Yep.
Did you say, DCS?
Yeah, they're not.
That's another.
Yeah, so maybe I'll have it by now. If I get it in between, of course, I'll send it out.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, and I go ahead.
Yeah, so if in reading my comments, and I didn't write down the number, I just wrote down a response about that mother not showing up for multiple meetings for the support coordinator and hadn't seen the member. And so I found it very interesting that in, I can't remember which policy it was, that they actually talked about how the support coordinators were supposed to send a certified letter to disenroll member. So it must have been this month when Morgan talked about my 26 comments. So somewhere in those comments had to do with that incident where the support coordinator couldn't contact the mother.
Okay. Do we need follow-up on that, or are we going to add that to the next month's agenda item, like we kind of chatted about?
I think Eva put it in the questions for the...
Okay.
Incident. So I just found out after I put it in the questions, what I found out real interesting is then when I was reading these early policies, that there was actually a policy on how to disenroll them. So it's just like, you know, sometimes I ask these stupid questions, and then I get back an answer that didn't seem right. I've been real happy with how the investigators have been answering questions and looking into different things.
Thank you.
So, does this mean, Lisa, I can make a motion that we adjourn our meeting?
Are we still waiting for a response, Eva?
No, I think
okay, thank you. Because I thought that I thought you had, the question was kind of left open. And I was looking for that policy piece. Okay. Yes, you can make a motion to adjourn the meeting. So if we don't have any more comments, and thank you guys all so much for participating. If someone can make a motion to adjourn the meeting, if we don't have any other comments or questions. And thank you guys all. And next time I'll be a little bit more diligent on determining if we're going to have guests prior to the meeting so that we can make a little bit of space for them. So I apologize on behalf of my part in that.
So you want to make it? I make the motion that we adjourn the meeting.
Thank you. Okay. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you guys all so much. Thank you for attending, everyone. And I'm glad we were able to get quorum and discuss this heavy subjects that we had today. Thank
guys,
you all.
I just want to share something. It is now 12:20 and we are proud of us.
All those in favor of ending the meeting, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Aye. Thank you all. We appreciate each and every one of you. Have a great weekend. Bye.
You too.
Friday.
Thank you.
Congratulations, great John. Weekend.